We look reality in the face and use it to accelerate our influence. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, August 27th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we sit down with Mel Schopp and Deb Soholt of Influential She. We'll talk about the high-leverage practice of what is. It's a reality check that could help provide essential clarity for leadership and influence. SDPB's Richard Tubbles joins us from the Red Cloud Studio to talk about standing up for kids in need. We've got state historian Ben Jones joining us for a conversation about the latest episode of the podcast History 605. Plus, Apollonia Davalo celebrates the connections of music with the Okie Dokie Brothers. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. State health officials report 193 cases of coronavirus in South Dakota schools during the first 2 weeks of the new year. Justin Zeitz is the superintendent of the Chamberlain School District. He says the district is doing what it can to protect students.
Hopefully everybody is going into it with the same mentality of we want to do what's best for our kids and we want to keep those kids in school and in activities. I don't think anybody in education has a different view, and hopefully none of the parents have a different view.
Zeitz says the district is not mandating masks yet, but will if the COVID situation in Chamberlain changes. The district is in Brule County, which has only a handful of new COVID-19 cases all summer. State climatologist Laura Edwards says recent rain is not enough to make a significant impact on the drought.
This week's drought monitor compared to last week shows very little change. And I think part of that is because we are so deep in drought impacts in agriculture and water supply.
Edwards says the state will likely be under severe drought conditions through the fall.
If we were to look at historical precipitation numbers and look how dry we are now, we would need maybe 150 to 300% of average rainfall in the next 3 months to really substantially improve our drought.
National Weather Service records show the Sioux Falls area is about 4 inches below normal precipitation this year. The Rapid City area is 6 inches below normal. South Dakota Mines and Rapid City is joining the fight to understand and disrupt criminal networks. The institution is partnering with researchers at South Dakota State University, Dakota State University, and the University of South Dakota to create the Center for Understanding and Disrupting the Illicit Economy. Dr. John Kellar is a professor at South Dakota Mines. He will lead a team focused on identifying counterfeit goods. Kellar says it's a widespread problem that can have big implications.
Let's say you buy a counterfeit purse. You think, well, I got a good deal and it looks good. And you probably think it's a victimless crime. Well, in fact, those products are being used by terrorists to generate cash to fund their networks.
Keller says it's important to be a conscientious consumer. Researchers will also focus on tracking fake pharmaceuticals and exploring the dark web and other networks used by criminals. State government provided a $4 million grant to create the center. A top South Dakota health official says rising COVID-19 cases are beginning to stress hospitals. Dr. Sean Carr Kura is vice president of medical affairs at Monument Health in Rapid City.
We're kind of seeing a similar situation as the past, and anytime you have a rising number of cases, it's going to put a strain on the health system. And we're seeing that here. We're seeing that everywhere, actually. Most big health systems are basically having to say we are full.
As few as 15 people were hospitalized with COVID-19 earlier this summer in South Dakota. The number recently surged above 140. Meanwhile, the Food and Drug Administration is fully approving Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for people age 16 and older. The FDA previously authorized the vaccine for emergency use. Kura says vaccines remain the best way to stop the coronavirus, including the Delta variant. He says the majority of current COVID-19 hospitalizations are unvaccinated people. With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. A program to help South Dakota high school students graduate and succeed in the workforce is expanding. Beth Schneider is the Executive Director of Jobs for America's Graduates in South Dakota, otherwise known as JAG. And Beth joins us now with an update. Beth Schneider, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Lori.
Let's help people understand what exactly Jobs for America's Graduates is, and then we'll talk a little bit about the places that it's expanding to.
Well, great. Well, Jobs for America's Graduates is a state-based nonprofit organization, and it's actually here in South Dakota, supervised by the Department of Education. And we help students persist through graduation. Really, our name, Jobs for America's Graduates, is what we do. We help graduates get jobs.
Tell me a little bit about how long this has been going on and what kind of success that you're seeing. You know, what is its impact right now?
Well, we've been in South Dakota for 13 years. It was originally piloted in the Wagner area, and we've just seen tremendous success. We've had nearly 100% graduation rates in the JAG program for the life of the program. I came on board a year ago. The legislature approved funding for the Department of Education to have a what we call a CSA or a state director, and that's my role. So for the last year, I've been able to support the programs that we have and really, just like you said, focus on growing the program. We're excited to have three new schools joining us this next year and look to continue to do that.
Where are those schools who are coming on board?
We're excited to have Lyman County, and which is their school is in Presho. We have Ulrichs, and then Sioux Falls Roosevelt High School has joined us this year.
All right. Tell us a little bit about how this works. How, you know, who is it for? Who are the kids that we're trying to connect with?
Mm-hmm. So these students have significant hurdles to graduation, something maybe their home life, maybe their living situation. They're just really disconnected from school. They might still be getting good grades, and they're just maybe not going to make it to graduation for one reason or another. It's not a priority. So we're looking for students who have been identified in their school as having some leadership potential, and they really want to grow that and stay in school. So the school identifies them, and then we have a JAG teacher who we call a specialist, and they're really the heart of the program. They work one-on-one with these students. They're in a JAG class with a small class of cohorts, and they just do project-based learning and really focus on staying connected to the school and building relationships.
All right. We talked about just, you know, some of the needs that kids might have. So where does a trauma-informed care come from, or sort of, information about what some of these students' lives have been like? How do you incorporate that into the relationship?
That is exactly right. The JAG Advantage really focuses on trauma-informed care and project-based learning and employer engagement. And that trauma-informed care really comes in with students bring in all of their junk, for better word, right? They just bring in all their stuff from home, and that's okay in the JAG classroom. Maybe in English class, they need to leave it at the door. Maybe in math class, just leave it at the door, focus on what you're doing. But in the JAG class, we think of it as the kitchen table where they can really talk through their issues and then focus on, okay, that's not a excuse. What are we going to do with that? How are we going to be better and get to graduation and be successful out in the world?
Yeah. What kind of workforce connections are there so that it's, because if you're part of this kind of group and you get to graduation, in some ways it's, you've lost a family in some ways too. So what's the next transition for many of these students?
That is a good point. They do. A lot of times when you graduate and you walk across that stage, you get your diploma, you're done. Mm-hmm. JAG is really unique in that our specialists, our teachers, they continue to follow up with their JAG students because they do have that relationship built with them for 12 months after their senior year. And so, okay, the student's going to go off to college. And you're like, great, okay, how many times do we know in May the student has signed up for college, but gosh, come September, maybe something happened and they didn't. Or we knew they were working at the local hardware store and now something happened and they're not. So we want to make sure that our students are supported beyond just their high school graduation and making those connections just across the state.
Yeah, South Dakotans taking care of one another. Not a bad plan.
Exactly.
Beth Schneider is Executive Director for Jobs for America's Graduates in South Dakota. And thank you so much for the update.
Well, thank you.
After the break, SDPB's Richard Two Bulls is with us. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
There is so much not to miss about going into work. The packed subway cars, the loud cubicle maids, but what about serendipitous meetings at the water cooler? On the next Planet Money, the case for and against going back to the office. And on How I Built This, a wildly successful real estate entrepreneur who never lost his fear of failure. That's on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 2 Central, 1 Mountain.
Program funding by MITGO Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at MITGO.com/business.
Jonathan Van Ness got an Emmy nomination this year for his work on the Netflix makeover show Queer Eye. But getting to that point required a lot of work to get over past trauma.
The sooner that you can talk about it, I think that the less it can wreak havoc in your life. And so I think that for people that have went through something like this, I want them to know that it doesn't have to ruin your life.
JBN on How to Heal. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, hosting world-leading research in physics and other disciplines. Learn more about America's Underground Science Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The Seventh Circuit CASA of the Black Hills. CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. That's an advocacy group for children that provides services to underrepresented kids who are in dire circumstances. SDPB's Richard Two Bulls is joining us now from the SDPB Red Cloud Studio in Pine Ridge. Richard, you're with us in Pine Ridge, and you have alongside you Executive Director of the Seventh Circuit CASA program, Kehala Two Bulls. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Kehala.
Hi, good morning.
All right, Richard, let's talk a little bit about CASA and, you know, and kids, because it's pretty important to you as a father as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously, you know, when it comes to investing in our future, the children in itself are our future. And, you know, one of the things is I want to leave this world a better place. You know, I have a 7-year-old son and a 7-month-year-old daughter. And
cute.
I think about...
Pause for cute effect.
I know. She has me by the heartstrings.
Yeah, they're both adorable, but yes. Go ahead, sorry.
So, you know, like, you've seen photos of her.
Yes, we're going to pause for baby pictures here on the radio. Go ahead, yeah.
So, you know, I think about what's happening right now, especially with the pandemic and, you know, the kind of world that I want to leave them. And, you know, my cousin-in-law, Kehala, she has this very perspective and a unique perspective on what it means to be a child advocate.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you brought your relative along. Kehala, tell me a little bit about you and how you got into this work and what it means for you.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here. So by training, I am a mental health counselor, and once I finished my program, I really thought a lot about what it meant to contribute to my community and to the world that we live in, and not go into a world of kind of elite armchair therapy, but how I could use what I'd learned and continue my learning to help people in my community. First, I worked in treatment, inpatient and outpatient treatment. Then I worked in homeless services, and eventually I came to CASA when we moved to South Dakota, back to my husband's community. And really all of it is working with the same population. We're working with families who've experienced trauma and how they're expressing trauma and unfortunately passing that along a lot of time, generation to generation. And I think it's really, it's powerful, it's difficult, but there's a huge potential to make a contribution, learn about people, and create a safer community like Richard said, for our children.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Lori, CASA provides a very unique service, you know, because it gives these children a voice. And, you know, Lori, sometimes these children don't get that opportunity to express themselves or even get a chance to, you know, process these complex feelings. And yeah. I really feel like this organization is providing these children who don't have a voice, you know, a voice.
Right. Okay, Hala, they wouldn't even know. I mean, emotions are hard to unpack. Trauma is hard to unpack when you're a grown up. For little kids, you might not even have the language for this. You might not even know this isn't normal if something has happened in your life that's traumatic. Is that hard work for you to kind of come into that space? I guess what I'm wondering is, do you ever regret not going to the elite armchair kind of moment when you're faced with the challenges in doing the work?
To be honest, it is hard work, and I don't regret it at all. I think the hardest work is the most rewarding, and people ask me a lot about burnout and how that affects me, and I'd be lying to say there aren't days that are heavier than others, but the truth is when we can create movement and change, we can avoid burnout. Mm-hmm. And I think something that's really powerful, though we spend a lot of time talking about how kids come to us, really the point is how we work with them and how we support them in who they are in the moment. And so though we work in a realm of trauma, really what we're working towards is resilience. And we're building that in ourselves, our children, our community. And that's how we can avoid that burnout and spark hope.
Yeah, I love what you just said there, Richard. We create movement and change, and that's how we avoid burnout. I wrote that down. I gotta put that on my that's something to remember in the days ahead. When you see the work is progressing, you see the good work that you're doing, that's what keeps mm-hmm. you going a little more. Now, you know, clearly South Dakota Public Broadcasting is a family, and family is so important to us. We take care of each other. You also need volunteers and advocates that can be part of that family role. I'm wondering what kind of relationship can an advocate foster with a child? What about those volunteers, Kehala?
Absolutely, and really that instilling resilience and meeting kids where they're at is what our advocates do on a daily basis. And it's so powerful because we don't have control at the end what's going to happen. You know, we don't have control over parents gaining sobriety and stability. We don't have control over decisions that judges may make or the mm-hmm. legal constraints that anyone works under. But we can be a safe, stable adult in a child's life, and we know that that builds a resilient capacity which will greatly diminish any of the adversity and the long-term after effects of trauma and adversity as kids go on to be adults and parents themselves.
Yeah, that's powerful. Richard, have you done work with CASA as well?
Yeah, I've you know, over my years with working in the local news industry here, I've done a lot of work with Kehala, and I really love her vision for what she's bringing in regards to her leadership to keep the children of, you know, the Black Hills area to have a voice. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's doing as much as she can to advocate for them. And, you know, these children live as much as a normal life under, you know, a CASA advocate.
Yeah, important stuff, especially, you know, getting those volunteers and the advocates signed up to help represent those kids. So we're just going to put that shameless plug out there. If this is something that you feel called to do, you know, do it. I've got some friends who will see a, you know, television commercial, or they'll hear something like this and they'll say, I think I could do that. Make that mm-hmm. phone call and reach out to see if you can help. We're going to wrap things up here from SDPB's Red Cloud studio, but I just want to give Kehala one more chance. Any final thoughts that you want to say as far as how people can reach out to be part of your work?
Absolutely. People who are listening locally in the Black Hills can go to casaofrapidcity.org, and people statewide can go to sdcasa.org and look at all the 6 programs serving different areas across South Dakota. But I truly believe that everyone either can be an amazing child advocate or knows someone in their network who can be. So help us amplify that message and help us create health and healing in our community. It really is a rewarding experience.
Yeah, nicely said. Richard Tubles, thank you so much for opening up the studio for us today. It's always great to hear your voice and to know that you're part of this studio conversation as well. So Richard, thanks as well.
Thank you, Lauren.
Kehala, thanks.
Thank you.
Ahead on the program, facing reality in order to increase your influence, we'll talk about what is next. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hollywood can be expensive, you know.
I remember sitting, you know, here in my office with a group of rare earth miners, and they were like, we have all this money, we'd like to invest it in movies.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Money talks in the movies next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota. It's growing season again for the arts and humanities. The American Rescue Plan is providing sizable federal grant funds to arts and humanities organizations across South Dakota. More at artssouthdakota.org/grants.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
SDPB covers issues of diversity and minority affairs, from Native Americans to recent immigrants. Support for SDPB's diversity reporting comes from the Rapid City Rotary Club through the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Deb Soholt and Mel Schaap are the brains behind the brand Influential She. They join us once a month to talk about how women can accelerate their influence through a series of high-leverage practices. Today, we're going to talk about their high-leverage practice of what is. That's the reality check that helps you get clear about where you're at so you can get to where you want to go. I spoke with Deb and Mel earlier this week. Today, we're going to do some truth slapping.
Some truth slapping.
I just love this phrase. Where did truth slapping come from? Which one of these minds?
That's Deb.
I'm like,
she's got to own that one. I loved it. She's used it before. Can't you just hear her say that?
Where does truth slapping come from, and how does it fit into the work that you do on Influential She?
Well, I think what's so interesting, we're going to talk a little bit today about our high leverage practice of what is.
Yeah.
And it's just really looking clearly at what is going on, some of the things that you bring to the situation, and then what is going on around you, the what is around you. And many times we just need to give ourselves a truth slapping. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's like, ow, oh my gosh, that like hurt to really look at it so straightforward, because I don't want to pay attention to what is really happening. It's easier to kind of segue off to the side and not pay attention to it. But yet, with Mel and I talking about, you know, what would have helped us in accelerating our influence in our careers and our lives, it's really about that incredible clarity. And This doesn't really mean judging yourself, because it's about almost suspending judgment, because too many times we want to go, well, that's good, that's bad. And so in my life, I've said, ooh, I just need a truth slapping right now. Like, I have to just look at it and say, what in the world is happening right now? What is going on? I don't have to react to it. I don't have to decide within it, but I really do have to pay attention to it. And it's in that truth slapping that you can really start to take steps forward.
Yeah. Mel, it seems like in the world that we live in today, in the world where we don't know what this virus is going to do, we have bad news every day that we turn on the radio or watch TV that's happening around the world. There are things you can't control. Talk a little bit about what is, in the sense of so much of life, we have control of a lot less of it than we think we do.
If that isn't true. You know, one of the things that we don't want this to be perceived as, you know, you always hear that phrase, it is what it is. Mm. Well, you know, it's not something we should just fall back on. It's kind of cliche. And then you almost get like paralyzed. And particularly in the situations you're talking about, Lori, because there is so much uncertainty right now. So it isn't a matter, you know, we're not saying that, you know, you just ignore what's happening with you or around us or wherever it is, but really paying attention to it. But then knowing that you can move on from there, because otherwise you do just get so swallowed up
in the enormity of the situation. And a lot of times it's on the negative side rather than trying to be, you know, find those places where you can find your way out. And it doesn't mean like you have to be a Pollyanna every day, but it really is just paying attention. Okay, this is what's happening. And we're going to have to own that, and we're going to have to move forward from that. And that sometimes is not easy, particularly, like you said, in these really hard, tough things that are going on around us right now.
Yeah. I like what is way better than it is what it is. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie St. Vincent with Bill Murray. And everyone, his wife is you know, dying, and they just, well, it is what it is. And he just he just pushes back against that phrase because it seems like everyone in his life is just telling him in this defeatist way that you just have to accept this. And I like what is better because it seems more empowering to me, Mel, just to invite the true slapping just by saying, what is happening? What is the situation that I'm living under right now? That seems more empowering to me than just, it is what it is.
Exactly. And not only that, but I think our what is that sometimes we forget that there's so many things from our past that influence what's currently happening in our lives, and sometimes we don't pay attention to it. And Deb, I think that's what you're talking about, where we really need to do that two-slapping, is, you know, owning that we come with baggage. And sometimes it's good baggage. I'm not saying it's all negative. But we are who we are today because of where we came from.
Yeah. We come with baggage, Deb.
Yeah, so when I think about my own true-slapping in my life, and I think about my dad, who was a wonderful father and just seriously loved his girls, but he really was a World War II, you know, kind of traditional guy that women only really were whole through the men that they married.
Sure.
And so in me, that kind of instilled a fight mode. And in my adulthood, I could see how there was a negative side to that truth for me, and that fight could lead to some defensiveness and to some, you know, caustic languaging. And if I felt there was this place where somebody was saying, well, women can't or whatever, that would show up in more of a defensive way. And once I really got clear about that and I kind of had a truth, I mean, I had to really say, oh man, that is a truth for me.
Yeah.
Then I could harness that fight in a more positive way and to turn it around into influence. So I still have that. Like if somebody says to me, well, you can't do that, I'm like, oh yeah, just watch me.
Watch me, yeah.
Just watch me.
This will be fun.
This will be fun. This will be fun. This is now sport instead of.
Yeah.
And so I think, go ahead, Mel.
You know, what's so funny is I think it's why Deb and I make maybe a good pair, because we've talked about those pieces where, you know, I was the absolute opposite. I was the pleaser all the time. I just was a peacemaker. And you know, you bring that forward, particularly as you take on leadership positions, that you realize you simply can't make everybody happy, unfortunately. Yeah. And so really the way that, you know, when we really talked about this and Deb and I sat down, we've looked back and, you know, thought about how we envisioned ourselves when we were younger and we brought that into our work. If we had thought about that earlier, it would have really helped us to really think forward on how we approach different situations, how we made decisions, how we did things, and so forth. So it's a really important piece that I know I've had to explore as well.
Mel, talk to the teachers who are waiting, have already this week or later on in the week, inviting kids back to school. Parents in your district are upset about masks or no masks. Parents are worried. You've got kids coming in who have been delayed for a year, and they're coming in at all different levels of education. What if you're standing in the front of that classroom waiting to welcome those kiddos inside, what is your what is at that moment, and what do you do next?
You know, I think right now what we have to be as cognizant of as anything is that there's an uncertainty, not only, you know, that educator that's standing in front of the room, but each one of those little ones is coming in hearing different things that they're bringing from home. Yeah. I think right now we just need to bring with a lot of acceptance and understanding that we can't control the way in which, you know, the situation of how they're feeling about, you know, that whether or not, you know, their parents accept a mask or not a mask, or how they're dealing with that. You just got to love them, you know, to death, and really give them some assurance that things are going to be okay. We all need that basic assurance right now that we're going to get through this together. And for teachers, they just are the heroes, along with our medical people from this past year. I mean, there's so many heroes, but boy, they've got, they're facing a new uncertainty. And I think there just needs to come with a lot of acceptance and not just giving in and saying, oh, this, you know, it's just, here we go again, but instead kind of thinking about how am I going to really love and support and accept these little ones and the parents and their decisions that they make just to get through the year? And that's what we're going to have to do.
And, you know, when Mel talks about this acceptance, I think to your point is like this whole idea of we could just say if we were it is what it is, we'd say, well, it's chaos. We have chaos instead of what is chaos exists right now. Mm-hmm. So within that chaos, how am I going to be clear about how we're going to be together? Mm-hmm. And I think it's part about that acceptance, but it's also to Mel's point about they're coming with all different philosophies from their home front, accepting the truth of that. That's a truth slapping. I can't change that. I can't change those parents. I can't control any of that. But what can I control? That we're going to accept, here's how we're going to be together. Mm. And this is going to be our new what is within this environment of chaos.
That works for every situation. These are the things I can't control at work, but this is how we're going to be together as a team. These are the things that I can't control about divorce, but this is how I'm going to be with my child at home. In a supporting and loving way.
And how I'm going to be with myself.
And how I'm going to be with myself, sure.
And how I'm going to be with myself.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
You know, there was a we interviewed, she was actually the National Teacher of the Year. Her name is Sarah Brown Wesleyan. And she had a couple really powerful statements. But one is sort of along this line where she says it's important for us to change the conversation around the idea of can you have it all or can you not have it all? I think we can relate that to are you on one side or the other side? But we shouldn't be looking at all these conversations as binary. It's not like either you can or you can't.
Right.
But if we can think about things over a period of time or and so forth. So I think sometimes we're coming into our conversations right now, particularly with their political or if they're in one way about one way or another. But things don't have to be binary. Things don't have to be can you have it all or can you not have it all? Mm-hmm. Or can you believe one way or not believe the other way? It's just this acceptance. And Deb, you really said it so powerfully about just being able to accept the situation as it is, and then we're able to move forward.
I have learned through this pandemic time that you can't hit pause in the hopes. I remember when it was like 10 days, like if we all, you know, Mike Pence was on TV and it was like 100 days, I think it was. Like if we all did this for 100 days, we could all. And I, you know, there was part of me that really wanted to believe that. And now I'm sort of have realized over the previous months that this isn't going away and I cannot afford to just do nothing except survive and wipe down my groceries for however long. I mean, I have to, you know, where is the influence? What am I doing? How am I taking care of myself? Am I exercising? Deb, talk a little bit about that because what is in the truth slapping also means like these limitations aren't going away tomorrow. You're not entitled or granted smooth seas.
No, we are not.
When you look at history, when back to the women in Afghanistan, look at what can happen that you have no control over, and there is no end in sight to it.
And I think, Lori, you have just brought up the perfect example of getting clear about the truth slapping.
Yeah.
So when you talk about, okay, if we're going into round two of the pandemic, and I've given this a lot of thought for myself, like, okay, I can't just have a glass of wine or two every night, you know, because I'm cocooned at home and be in my sweatpants and let it go. You know, I need to get clear about how the world that I live in has dramatically changed for this point in time. And now I have new choices to make because the truth of the matter is how I handled the first round of being more isolated from people was not good for me.
I'm just going to bring one more. I know I talked to her before, but there's another really powerful quote that the Sarah Brown Wesley made, and then Deb can jump in with some others. But I think that when we think about, when we talk about these good things or bad things that are happening, one of the statements she makes, if you really think about this, she says, when really good things or really bad things happen in your life, just highlight or they illuminate the reality of what's already there. You know, whether people are going to a bad relationship and so forth, sometimes when something really good happens, something really bad happens, it just highlights or illuminates what's already out there. And really, if we're able to step back and look at it from that lens, then we're able to make a step forward. And we just aren't, you know, again, like stuck in the reality of what's happening at that point in time. Those things are really, really important to do. And that's a piece that doesn't leave us wanting. It lets us develop further and go further with that. And so I think that, to me, has always resonated when she said that. It's like, oh, yeah, it was probably there all the way along.
Right. That that resonates with me. Yeah.
And we think it just showed up. Yeah. And yet it's something that's been lurking all along.
Yep.
But this high or this low really then brings it forward into our consciousness.
Mm.
I think another thing that we hear from our podcast guests is on this whole idea of what is the really assessing what's going on. Like if you're going into a workplace or we come in all gung-ho, we want to change everything, but to sit back and to really start to look around and understand what is. Who is in power? Mm. Where's the informal power? What is the culture? How are decisions going to be made here? Instead of coming in all excited and then disappointed when we're trying to pursue something, but we haven't paid attention to the real what is, even if we don't really like it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what's being said in a mission, for instance, but here's how it's really being played out. If that's the what is and what's the power structure within that, then how do I fit? How do I start to move something forward in a way that can actually have influence instead of just coming in all gung-ho and going against the traditional what is? Now, it doesn't mean over time you can't affect that. And the higher you get into some decision-making authority, you have more authority to do that. But so many times I think we're disappointed because we haven't really assessed what is. Instead of saying, well, this is more male-centric. I guess I'm going to have to figure out how to work within that.
Yeah.
Or this is something that doesn't have enough cash flow to do whatever. That's a what is. So now I'm going to have to work within that and start instead of fighting all of those forces at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But really trying to assess it clearly and stepping back and taking some time to do that, that can really help to accelerate your influence.
Mm. Interesting stuff. You can find more Influential She online at influentialshe.com. We'll also put some links up in today's In the Moment show notes at sdpb.org/news. Let's take a moment now for Eliza Blue's Postcard from the Prairie.
In 1877, a young woman named Anna Sewell published a book called Black Beauty, The Autobiography of a Horse. The book has since sold 50 million copies in 50 languages worldwide and is considered to be one of the most popular books of all time. Anna meant her book to be a call to action for the improved treatment of horses. By framing Black Beauty's story as an autobiography, readers were moved to empathize with the horse's struggles and mistreatment at the hand of humans. It worked, and the result was legislative and societal change. Now, one of those 50 million copies was purchased for my mother when she was a child. She read and reread the story many times, staying up too late on summer nights, engrossed in a tale from a time when horses still pulled cabs and carts, and self-propelling automobiles were a figment of the collective imagination. Later, she read the book to her own children, and I loved the story too, though it broke my heart. I vowed one day to have a horse of my own who I would protect and honor, and would love me and I would love back. A few stints at horse camp and a few trail rides while on vacation were as close as I got until I came to live here on the ranch. I was ecstatic at the prospect of getting to know the horses here, certain it was the beginning of a relationship I had been waiting for most of my life, based solely on the impression that Black Beauty had given me. Namely, that horses were just like humans, only better. Imagine my surprise the first time you discovered that horses can be real jerks, especially to one another. Bring a new horse into an established pack, and the pack will make schoolyard bullying look like a kindness. They bite, they kick, they chase, they scream at the newcomer as everyone tries to figure out how best to integrate the interruption to group life. Horses can be equally obnoxious to humans, although thankfully they usually aren't. We humans aren't part of their social fabric, so it's less important to show dominance in our presence. However, I've seen plenty of horses that will buck or squeal or run away at the first sight of a bridle, or generally make life difficult for their riders. Black Beauty's endless obedience and willingness to serve are not, it turns out, a universal trait in horses. Yes, with training, they will let us saddle them and ride around on their backs, and they will go where we lead them, which I don't mean to devalue because that is pretty cool, especially when they outweigh us by so much. But it's by no means a seamless love affair. Or anyway, that's my takeaway after 7 years of rant horses that I have tried to make love me, but like so many of the men I dated in my 20s, have in turn made it very clear they'd rather hang out with their friends. This week, a new horse came to live on our ranch. He is mostly black with a white blaze on his beautiful long nose and one white sock. The exact physical attributes Anna gave her eponymous character. He is a stranger to the rest of the horses, so we haven't put him out into the pasture yet, instead letting everyone assess the situation with the safety of fences separating them. I visit him in the warm twilight. The little kid part of my brain is still waiting to meet my new best friend. The adult part of me knows better. He is bored and hot, swatting flies with his tail and stopping to shake them off his legs. He lets me pet him, but only if I have oats. Relationships with horses, just like all relationships, grow and change over time. I am not this horse's salvation, and he is not mine. But that doesn't mean we won't be friends. Learning to trust the other's good intentions over 1,000 evenings of snacks and quiet dusks.
Find more from Eliza Blue online at elizablue.net. Up next, History 605 explores the Battle of Wounded Knee. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, how your solar panels can help our climate crisis.
It's really important if we're going to make a dent in things like the total amount of emitted carbon that we make solar much more pervasive than it is now.
And why being bird brain saved these dinosaurs from extinction.
Birds have really complex, gigantic brains.
It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Dozens are dead, including several U.S. service members, after a terrorist attack at the Kabul airport. President Biden says the evacuation of Americans and Afghan allies will continue.
We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
What we know about the attack and the U.S. response this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility. Advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. State historian Ben Jones joins me now in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Today we're previewing a book by author Jerome Green. It's called All Guns Fired at One Time, Native Voices of Wounded Knee, 1890. The book is an effort to expand the narrative of the massacre to include voices and archival research not seen in one place before. Ben Jones, welcome. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Good to see you, Lori.
This is an example of a book that is so needed and probably a great example of what we can learn from historical archives and different viewpoints. Tell me a little bit about All Guns Fired at Once, and when you talked to the author, where this story began from him. Was there a central question that he was exploring as an editor?
Right. Well, Jerome Green has researched these issues for quite a while. I think most of his professional life he's dealt with this topic, Native American in the Great Plains and Western history and so forth. And he's written other things about Wounded Knee. One of the things that if you're going to put a book together that tells the narrative story of an event, you need to cobble together a healthy dose of the primary subjects, the primary sources on something. And with this particular event, because a lot of these sources were kind of behind a screen of firsthand account memories written down by family members, firsthand account memories taken by reporters in papers that were all over the country, and then subsequently printed and read and thrown away, and then some microfilmed and wind up in archives and so forth, and then some done in interviews later, 20, 30, 40 years after the fact, that he thought it was an interesting project to have those firsthand accounts spread across time and across those mediums. Mm-hmm. For a reader who's interested in, okay, tell me what those who were there actually said about what happened to them.
Yeah. Many of the voices I heard in your interview with him were women who told stories mm-hmm. years later. Why is that? Tell me a little bit about some of the female voices and what they added to that narrative and as eyewitnesses.
Yeah, I think what he talks about in that in the podcast interview and during the book is that those sources came along later because of efforts by those survivors, their family members, the wider tribal community, and many people in Washington to get reparations or to make an official apology on behalf of the U.S. government for what had happened. And so a lot of people said, I was there, this is what happened, in a kind of a testimonial mm-hmm. effort to create a record to help those in power determine what should be done.
For people listening now who don't know what it is we're talking about, explain what mm-hmm. happened, explain what the massacre was and
sure.
how we remember it today.
Sure. Wounded Knee occurred in late December of 1890. So if you picture, just setting the scene, South Dakota has been a state for a year and nearly 2 months, okay? The western part of the state had largely been one big reservation, but in the late 1880s, so just two or three years prior to that, the reservations were broken up through a series of legal maneuvers and so forth, and into what largely, not quite, but mostly what the reservations are today. Also going on in the western part of the United States in various places was the Ghost Dance, and this set off in certain quarters on a couple of reservations in South Dakota a great deal of fear and concern by Indian agents. So those would be the people from Washington sent to run the reservation, that the Ghost Dance was prompting a kind of a religious revival that was going to get out of hand and the Native Americans were going to become violent again. One of the people that was thought to be heavily participating in the Ghost Dance was Sitting Bull, and there was a group that was with him. The Indian agents went to arrest Sitting Bull, and shots were fired, and Sitting Bull was killed on December 15th. Many of the Indians that were up there at Cheyenne River Reservation were then asked by Red Cloud to come down to Pine Ridge. And so they traveled down right around Christmas, just after Christmas, walked down to Pine Ridge to join that agency or that reservation with Red Cloud. And on their way, they were stopped by elements of the 7th Cavalry, which had been the same unit in 1876 that had been wiped out in Custer's command there in Montana. So there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of mistrust. And the commander of the 7th was probably, I think it's probably safe to say, is one of the worst commanding officers in the history of American military history. Just bumbled what should have been a fairly straightforward, even in the confusing time and events, but in the effort to confiscate weapons from the Lakota tribes, one rifle went off, and then, as the title of the book says, all guns fired at one time, and the response from the 7th Cavalry against mostly unarmed, as far as we know, mostly unarmed, but a lot of women and children were killed, about 150.
When we talk about this narrative being referred to as a battle at one point and then being referred to as a massacre, I want to get at this idea, talking with you as a historian. I mean, this is Jerome Green's edited book, mm-hmm. but I'm curious for your perspective too. The way we look at these things changed. There was a reason mm-hmm. that narrative was crafted in a certain way at the time.
Yeah.
Walk me through some of that.
Well, the events in the immediate aftermath of the battle of the massacre were controversial at the time. The commanding officer in South Dakota was a man by the name of Nelson Miles, who
this is the worst commander of
No.
No. What was that gentleman's name?
The worst commander was a gentleman by the name of Forsyth. He was the colonel of the 7th Cavalry.
Okay.
His boss was a major general and at the time headquartered in Rapid City. Miles was not on the scene. When Miles gets to the scene and sees what happens, he's disgusted. He never had much respect for Forsyth in the first place. But it turns out that Forsyth and the 7th Cavalry was wired into the Washington and Army politics in a way that shielded them from an investigation that Miles wished to do. Mm. So within the Army, there was a great debate. The Secretary of the Army wanted to award decorations for some of the soldiers, and Medals of Honor were handed out to about 20 soldiers of the 7th Cavalry.
Why was that decision made? Because clearly we're still talking about whether those medals should be rescinded.
Yeah.
What were the politics of that decision being made at the time?
I think, you know, a lot of bravado about, oh, the 7th Cav. And I think there probably, it's a lot of speculation, and I've not gone through the
details. We're off script now, Ben
Jones. Yes, we are.
We did not go there.
I headed into the records for that conversation, but
I know.
I think that the politics of that at the time, there's a book about that, in fact, by Richardson is her name. She's a historian, has written a book about that. It's a pretty accessible book about the Washington politics that led to the outcome at Wounded Knee. And
you know what I'm going to ask you?
What's that?
I can't help it.
Yeah.
Take them back? Rescind those medals?
I certainly think that a review is warranted. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that, that a proper, full review by the United States Army is certainly warranted.
What gets in the way of something like that happening? Bureaucracy?
I think, a lot of members of Congress probably want to know, is it warranted? Our own state legislature last year asked Congress to mm-hmm. conduct such a review. And the debate that they've had last year and I think the preceding year about a similar bill has been very interesting to listen to. I think, you know, you can dial it up on the mm-hmm. legislature's webpage and listen to that discussion and so forth. I think people are, as a historian, I would want to have solid, pretty much irrefutable evidence, almost like a courtroom, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, mm-hmm. that those medals were awarded improperly. Okay? So that may be easy to prove, and that's why I think that the United States Army should do a review. There are members of the 7th Cavalry today and for the past 10, 20 years that desperately want those medals taken back. They think it's a slam on the on their illustrious unit.
It's a stain
unit.
On the 7th Cav. Is that's what, From my perspective and the people that I've met, that's always been the American military perspective has been, come on, it's time to look at that again.
Right. Well, and the fact that the two-star at the time thought that it was a disaster and a massacre, it needs to be looked into.
All right, let's go back on. We don't really have a script, but we didn't expect to go there. And I couldn't help myself because I just think it's so compelling. But this is Jerome Green's book we're talking about and History 605 podcast. And what did you find in this book that you found as a historian, from a historical standpoint, all this content together, all these narratives together, I found that fascinating as a layperson. How about for you?
He saves you tons of time by putting it all in one place, right? You don't need Google, and you don't need a big library, a university library. He puts it all there. In fact, there are newspapers that he had in personal collections or that were provided to him by people who had them in personal collections that no longer exist. So that's the kind of historical mining that a guy like Jerry Green can do just because he's so well connected among the community of scholars who study this. And somebody finds out, oh, you're working on that? Well, you ought to talk to this guy who has newspapers and he's the only one who has a copy. And,
and the press itself, that's the kind of thing.
Right. And in the press itself, I mean, the mm-hmm. East Coast press, they're the ones who refer to it as a battle.
No, I mean the book itself being from,
The, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Mr. Yeah. Yes, the Historical Society Press.
Yeah.
Right.
that's the kind of thing that you can put into the world for people to more fully and more richly understand our history.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
As state historian, that's part of
That's what the whole reason for being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing that's really interesting about the book is just like any traumatic event that people might witness, whether it's a crime scene, whatever the case may be, your memory of the event 2 seconds after, 2 days after, 20 years after is going to go through some changes. Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting to see in the book is the testimonials or the memories that were immediately following the battle, then the testimonies that were later that might have been in the in a newspaper or a historical study or for these inquiries that were looking into it, or in a diary that was found when the audience was yourself. You know, that's the thing that makes being a historian interesting is when you talk about, when you have a document in front of you, you really have to assess who's the audience for this really.
Right.
In this, whether it's an official report or a diary or a letter to a spouse, you know, who's the audience and what kind of frame should I put this artifact into in order to understand it best?
Hmm. Well, I really want to ask you about R.F. Pettigrew's role in this, because isn't he the I used to work at the Pettigrew Museum.
Oh, okay.
Bill Hoskins, give me a call because I'm going to forget my Pettigrew history.
Yeah, Bill, and you may know more about that than I do.
Yeah, he is the senator who
he is the senator
who has the Indian agent who basically it's a crony. Essentially, of R.F. Pettigrew, who really doesn't understand what the ghost dance is, and there is some kind of connection. And I am out on a limb right now, Ben Jones, so I'm going to have to do some fact-checking after this. But when I worked at the Pettigrew Museum, when I worked at the Siouxland Heritage Museums, I just remember that there was this sense of who you brought in to be an Indian agent mattered, and the consequences in this case were dire.
They were. And these Indian agents are political appointments.
Yeah.
And their qualifications, that, you know, all of this occurs, or because things like this occur, people like Teddy Roosevelt come along and say, we need to reform government because we need professionals in our government doing jobs they know how to do. And this was just one of the more stark reasons about why Teddy Roosevelt was right about that.
It's just a good conversation about history, and it's measured and thoughtful, and I thank you for having it. Mm-hmm. And people can find History 605 on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, and listen to Ben Jones talk with Jerry Green. I saw Jerome Green at the Festival of Books, which is also coming up. He gave a fascinating presentation, and this book is really interesting as well. So thanks for stopping by and
having
a little history talk with us, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, thanks.
That podcast drops on Monday. By the way, you can subscribe to History 605 at any time, though, and get caught up.